Aditya Venkateshan is head of employer branding at Meesho and previously at Gojek. In 2018, he was handed a problem by Gojek. Can you help us attract the right kind of talent? In this CTQ Smartcast, Aditya tells us how he went about doing so, his definition of employer branding, why trust and authenticity are so vital for the success of this role, why being open and about your fallibilities is so important, why leaders need to be storytellers, and how he persuaded engineers to contribute to stories of both success and failure at work. He is in conversation with me, Ramanand. For more conversations on culture and stories, subscribe to the CTQ Smartcast on YouTube and on all podcasting platforms. And do visit us at choosetothink.com. The think is spelled with a Q. Enjoy this conversation.
This is the CTQ Smartcast, where we have conversations about up-leveling, deliberate practice, and getting future relevant.
Hi, I'm Ramanand from the CTQ Smartcast. Today, I have Aditya Venkateshan with me to talk about all things employer branding. Hi, Aditya. Welcome to the CTQ Smartcast.
Hey, thanks, Ramanand. Thanks for having me.
So, Aditya, I want to learn a lot more about how you got into employer branding. But first, what is employer branding?
Got it. Honestly, even I don't know for sure. Stumbled on this role when I was working with Gojek, right? So the way I started off with Gojek is I had a problem statement. Mm-hmm. And the problem statement was, we don't have a product here, but we have really, really interesting work and really, really interesting challenges. But we are unable to hire at the pace in which Indian companies that have products are able to hire, right? So when you have a consumer-facing app, it gets a lot more easier to hire because people can check out your app, like your Swiggy and Zomato and all of these, right? And then when you have Freshworks and the likes, you tend to use those apps when you're working with other companies. So in some way, you get some relevance to it. But the problem Gojek had was you couldn't use the app, right? And therefore they lost that huge chunk of an opportunity. And Gojek essentially said, okay, they hired a PR agency. And then they said, okay, help us, you know, hire more people, get us some publicity and things like that. Now, conventionally, PR looks at leaders and say, okay, we're going to give you publicity. Or they say, tell me what announcements you have. Now, Gojek didn't really have announcements. Like, well, what do you announce, right? But then they realized, okay, this is not working out. I need to figure this. And so they said, okay, let's look at some marketer to do this, right? And that's how I joined Gojek. And they said, okay, look, this is our problem statement. And we need to hire more talent. Let us know what we should do. And that's how I joined Gojek. Little did I know that what I was doing was known as employer branding, right? But that's how it started. And I think after 2 years later, people just figured out, okay, this is known as employer branding, and I got slotted into that, right? But what I did was looked at engineering product sort of design problems. And I said, okay, these are interesting challenges and problems. And then I took typical marketing conventional sort of tactics and merged both of them together. And that became the genesis of how we looked at this whole employer branding role. Now, what does the role mean? I've spoken to, I think, about 8-9 unicorn companies now, more than 24 odd startups. And everybody has a version of how this needs to be done, right? Some of them want this role to report into HR because they're like, okay, it's all talent related. Some of them want this role to report under a product, right? Because, okay, we can get to know about product. Some of them reported into engineering because, hey, companies like Gojek and, they've tasted a lot of success around it. So maybe that's where it needs to be. Some companies report into recruitment because ultimately it's a recruitment job. Some companies report into marketing because, okay, we need conventionally marketing tactics and the external facing social channels. So you have to have great content and copy, and we can't define it anywhere there. So yeah, everyone has a different take on it, but the role in my best summary, I could potentially say it's the ability to attract talent for sure, but it's also convey the pulse of the brand in some fashion, because your marketing team is focused on core marketing objectives. It could be app installs. It could be increasing your sales in some fashion. It could be promotions and discounts. Or it could be growth marketing, all of that, right? No one's focusing on core brand, which is, how do I drive perception for this company? And I think that's where magic for employer branding lies. It's a function of being able to attract talent, being able to do a little bit of public relations and making sure your senior leadership is positioned well. Lastly, how do you drive perception about this brand that they have top of the mind recall when a particular emotion is invoked or a particular word is invoked? Like when you think of food, you want to be saying, okay, Swiggy is top of the mind, right? Yeah, so that's a brief overview of a mishmash of everything under one employer branding.
Yeah, so what I love about this origin story is that it starts with the problem. It's not as if here is a role, we've been doing this forever, just come and fill it. But start with the problem statement and bring a bag of tricks to it, which you know people may have overlooked. And just looking at your background, right? You've been a student of journalism. You've written on, say, equity markets. You've been an account manager. You've done PR. You worked with CMOs. And in some sense, it looks like you were just accumulating those bag of skills. And I think most importantly, you were not an engineer. I think if I could say that, because it looks like this needed a fresh approach to solving the problem. So any thoughts on how these different parts to your background actually helped you ease or do well in this role of yours when you first got into employer branding?
Got it. Huge, right? I think all of these decisions that I made ultimately sort of accumulated to where I'm getting now, right? And I wish I could have done this a long time back, but then I always felt like every defining moment I took in my career was also a huge function of luck, right? And I'll walk you through that. So I started off with journalism because I did journalism, right? So that was an easy decision, right? But the beauty is when I joined Reuters, I wasn't doing conventional sort of journalism. I was reporting on equity markets, but not a typical reporter in that sense. But I got a nose for numbers. So I started understanding numbers and the importance of numbers. And that really, really helped because it gives you the ability to win trust with senior leadership, right? When you quote numbers, when you quote data, at some fashion, they understand, okay, you know my industry, right? So when you typically talk in that language, total addressable market, here's my customer acquisition cost, and so on and so forth, they like that sort of language, right? So journalism helped me with that. And then I just read voraciously. The most cliched advices are some of the best advice. And reading voraciously just sort of helped me understand the space. So that's how journalism started. From journalism, I moved to PR because I didn't see a future in journalism anymore, right? And there are a lot of reasons for that. And one of them is very simply, I realized I'm not going to get paid as well. And look, I'm a hedonist at the end of the day. And I cared for, living the other pleasures of life. And I realized journalism is never going to give me a breakout career, for sure. Number two is also, I realized I don't have the talent for it. Because journalism is about, you have to stay wired to your sources. There's no off day. Because look at the trajectory of this, right? Companies put out the worst news they possibly have on a Friday evening. Because that's, making a journalist lose a will to really, take that time, cover the story. And it's a painful process, right? So it never really worked out. Like journalism is it's a ruthless job. And it's a very, very hard job to maintain sources, pick out these sources, so on and so forth, right? So I did that for 2 years, learned a lot. And then I moved from journalism to public relations. Again, stumbled upon this career. It was almost thrown as a challenge to me. Didn't really have much. So I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to take it. And I quickly realized that public relations in India is not up to the mark. And that's the most diplomatic way of me putting it, right? Probably still holds true today because you'll see almost everyone complaining that, PR in India is just poor. But what happened was I just realized, okay, look, if this is the industry, I get to sort of make a niche in PR, right? So I just started writing voraciously there. So I went from reading quite a bit. And the irony of that was I was in journalism, but I wasn't writing as much. But I moved to PR and then I started writing. So I did a lot of shadow writing for a lot of senior leaders in the industry, right? So I did that for a whole bunch of folks. And again, very, very lucky because I was in the thick and thin of the startup boom. I'm talking 2013, 2014. This is when startups were multiplying like hordes, right? I mean, not as much as it is now, but let's say the groundwork was being laid then. And I got very fortunate because I worked with some really cool companies. So InMobi, Razorpay, worked with a lot of enterprise companies as well, like Red Hat, Salesforce, a little bit on Quicker. So a whole bunch of companies like that. DigitalOcean was another great client. I did a bunch of really amazing work like that. And that just sort of got into this amazing narrative of being able to look at public relations but a little bit from a brand point of view. So the moment I started working with a lot of these CMOs, I just sort of understood, okay, writing is an obvious skill that not many folks have, right? Then for some companies, I also started doing internal communications, which is the CEOs wanted to write something to the entire org, inspire the org. I started doing a lot of that. So I used writing as the sort of bulwark to be able to explain and propagate what I would think would define a good career, right? So I saw a lot of relevance in doing public relations. But after about three and a half years or so in PR, I came to a point where I realized, okay, it's one person advising a bunch of CMOs or head of marketings and or you know your head of PRs and whatnot. And that message, A, gets lost in translation. B, is up to them to decide whether they want to do or not. So it becomes like a typical consultant, right? Where you're preaching, but practicing is not in your domain at all. So therefore, you're probably not doing as well as you should, right? And of course, ideas are easy. Execution, extremely hard. So I went from that mold now to understand, okay, I've been doing this for a while now, but I want to pick one company and do this for one company. And how much success can I have for that one company? And I realized I don't want to pick a typical sort of consumer facing company. And I wasn't sure how much I would be able to do there and the level of risk people would take. So Gojek, again, I stumbled upon. I was speaking to a journalist friend and then he was telling me about Gojek and he was telling about how they're expanding. So I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot. I did a quick audit of Gojek and then I wrote a pitch mail saying, hey, here are things you should be doing. Here's what you're not doing. And yeah, it just made sense. And then that's how I came to Gojek and joined Gojek. And in Gojek, started with the problem statement. Had no idea what it is Gojek wanted to do at that point. But then as we started building upon this, all these pieces came together.
Lovely. You also mentioned the fact that for different people in the organization, employer branding fits in different places. It could be talent acquisition for some, HR for some, maybe product for others. So clearly there is a role or the tentacles of the employer brand function actually, you know, kind of span all through the organization. I almost see it like, an embedded journalist in the, with that military, war kind of teams take along with themselves to tell their side of the story because someone's got to be on your side telling your story. Yeah. So, one question I had was that, do you think employer branding has always been a sort of a unmet, unfulfilled need, unspoken need? Or has something changed in the last decade, with lots more competition for talent? We're actually at the very peak of it this year, in the last couple of years. So do you think it's always the need for it has been around always, or is it something has changed to kind of bring it to the forefront?
For sure. I think the last 2 years, a lot has changed, right? And primarily among them is, so this is also COVID acceleration, I feel, right? The moment COVID hit, people started working at home and eventually people also started realizing, okay, we can work remotely. And if we really can work remotely, we can work with any startup in the world, not just the ones in India. And if we can do that, we can command significantly higher salaries. So what people started doing is they had at least initial days, then later it became crazy, right? People started working like crazy, but initial days people realized they had a lot of time. And that time, I know a significant amount of people who started taking like a second gig or like a consulting gig, right? And saying, okay, where does this consulting gig take us? And then they realized, A, their talent is far higher than their peers in other organizations, especially the ones in the US and things like that, right? And they're getting a similar or if not much, much higher pay, right? And the latter holds true even till date, right? And therefore, everyone just realized they're far more employable and in perpetuity. So now the arbitrage is, what are you offering me apart from just money? Because I know I can get that anywhere, right? So the moment that came into the forefront, everyone realized, okay, we need to narrate our story better. Like, here's why it makes sense for you to be associated with the company. Now, if you look at someone who is really, really good, right? Like, let's say a senior leader, employable anywhere, can walk into any organization, they're happy to hire them. These kind of folks want to be associated with companies that have an interesting story, number one. They want interesting problems and challenges. Let's assume everyone has the ability to offer you interesting problems and challenges. Obviously, pay and all of that, anyone can, again, offer you a great pay. So the only real difference became how is my company sort of more interesting number one, and how many like-minded people can you come and work with? So then culture with a combination of peers and you know, all of these interesting other visions that we have for the company mattered so much more, right? So once those came in the forefront, employer branding became like a big, big deal to have. Because typically, otherwise, your organizations focus on marketing and then they focus on a facet of public relations, which sort of worked, sort of didn't work, you know, took its time, sometimes didn't take its time and did not work, so on and so forth. But now everyone wants to build out a talent branding side which accelerates this whole idea of here's what my company stands for. Here's how we're different. Here's why we have interesting challenges and we're doing interesting things. And yeah, that's I feel like now all the companies I've spoken to are figuring out how it needs to work. And there is an obvious template to go about it. But the paucity of talent to be able to write really well and convey this is where things is where there's chaos and where there is a dire need for a gap to be filled.
Right. So I'm from Pune, and you know, Pune was legendary at one point for its shops too. For its customer service or lack thereof. In fact, there was a humorist who once said that the most neglected item in the shop was the customer. And you know, Pune has come a long way off from there, where today customers will get noticed by the shopkeeper. And I think similarly, you know, the employees were someone you could kind of take for granted. You know, you could kind of throw out the scraps and you could have them come to you. But the power equation has definitely shifted in favor of the employees. So since you mentioned things like, you know, the nature of culture, the nature of who will you get to work with and what do you get to work, it's a combination. So what are the foundations of a really good employer brand? You know, do you have to start with a really strong mission, values, yeah, the things that people kind of just did as an exercise and then put it on a plaque and forgot about it. Do they really have to take it seriously now?
So the employer branding person, like, so this is where things get tricky, right? Mm. Because an employer branding role is in some ways already set up for success. Mm. In the sense, if you don't have this core foundation of a great culture, correct, the employer branding person cannot come and change it, correct, right? So this is a tricky thing. The employer branding person comes in to narrate what already exists. If what already exists does not exist, then the employer branding person cannot do anything, right? So in many ways, they're not really building much, but in organizations, they have the ability to identify and say, look, this is where things are not going well. These are the gaps in the organization. And so again, different organizations work differently, right? In some organizations, I've noticed the HR teams know what is missing. Right, because they do a dipstick analysis of what are the other orgs offering, and they have a fair idea to do this. In smaller organizations, probably they don't have that because HR is payroll and all of that, right? Because it's too small to have like HR and a team and things like that. This is where the employer branding person sort of tends to shine, right? Because they're saying, hey, we need to do better by employees. We need to have a sort of code of conduct. We need to have like a vision statement to rally around, things like that. But I still feel a lot of companies' mission, vision and all are things that are these pithy one-liners that someone just concocts out of nowhere, which I think it's good to call it like the Pune problem for all companies. It's just some random statement which does not make sense, right? And great companies have a strong understanding of the importance of this. And an example for this is Stripe, right? Stripe's vision is to increase the GDP of the internet. What a beautiful line. And if you see all the activities they do, is amazingly aligned to this whole idea about increasing sort of the gross domestic product of the internet, which is transactions and now they're getting into crypto and so on and so forth, right? And a lot of companies have pithy one-liners just don't make sense. But yeah, it would be unfair, and I've said this before, right? It would be sort of preposterous to suggest that an employer branding person comes and dictates how the culture of an org should function, right? And I've again also said this. Imagine an employer branding person comes and says, okay, you need to change engineering and this is how engineering should be done, right? Because then the organization has far more complex problems to solve. Yeah, but having said that, going through the exercise, right, which is figuring out all of these things, and as you rightly pointed out, an embedded journalist in the org, going through this fact-finding mission about how the org works as well. Because I don't know how many people you shoot a survey and then how many people will say this to HR. But when an employer branding person has to fish out stories, dig out, okay, tell me where are the areas you failed? Why has this product failed? What is not working in this product, right? You get to learn a lot more interesting insights. If that can be packaged, if this person has a seat in the table, if your founders are willing to listen and figure out a way in which we need to improve the org, then of course this role will shine, right? And then it also depends on how willing are the founders to be acceptable about these mistakes. For some reason, I've always noticed organizations want this bar clean image where they're saying nothing is wrong. Don't talk about anything that's wrong. Everything is perfect, right? But in Gojek, for example, some of the best success stories we've had are from stories where we spoke about failures, where we spoke about things that are not working. And that just became very authentic because everyone just realized, okay, Gojek is doing great stuff, but hey, they messed up as well. But then like, okay, wait a second. Why are they talking about areas where they messed up? Like, which organization is so open to talking about where their product is? I mean, we've seen this on Swiggy. We've seen this on a lot of other apps where for 3 hours they've had downtimes or 1.5 hours downtimes. But no one talks about what happened. How can we get better? Here are the mistakes we made. Here are changes we're doing, right? That those are far and few in between. But I think those deeply well-narrated stories make for great reading, but also speaks in some fashion to the culture of the org.
Right. And all stories are about, you know, they involve some kind of a conflict or some kind of failure. And I remember some of the posts you mentioned, the Gojek posts, the failure posts, I think a lot of resonance. I know a lot of people who read that, shared that kind of post. In fact, in our own work, we have been telling people about the role of culture in staying relevant in the future. And if you espouse the value of openness or fairness, you better have a few stories where a leader failed at it, admitted it, and that builds that trust like nothing. Because otherwise, it is just an extended form of PR within the organization, right? And it's not good enough. So, how important is authenticity in communicating, you know, the brand? Like, especially for the founders, the people sort of saying, "Yeah, this story, you know, it doesn't show us in great light, but it's an authentic story." So, how much do you have to counsel people in being authentic? About also recognizing, no, we are not there yet. We don't have the greatest talent perhaps right now to talk about, but we have this other thing that we should focus on. So tell me a little bit about the authenticity side to all of this.
Extremely, extremely important, right? And this is the problem. When you hire people, you know, telling them that amazing company, great culture, and when they join and they realize things are not as good, they're never going to be happy. You're a snake oil salesman, right? Like you're getting them in the hope that everything is good, but things are chaotic, right? But it's so much more easier to tell them, look, things are broken. Here are problems I have. I need you to come and fix these things. Being open about those things are far, far more beneficial than us, trying to portray everything in good light. In fact, I mean, anecdotally, if I would say this, for Gojek, so many of Gojek's hires, all this heavy lifting was done by the senior leadership at Gojek, right? Where they said, look, failure of systems, have a lot of problems that we need to deal with financial regulations. And we need to counsel sort of the bank and folks at the government, and we need to figure out how to do this better, right? We need to improve our own storytelling to how we have to explain this to officials in the banks and other folks there, right? So very, very important. And what also folks don't realize is the moment you show you're sort of valuable as an organization, you're showing core areas where someone can come and build out something very, very interesting, right? And engineers crave for this, right? They crave for great problems. Product folks crave for great problems. But if you're coming in and you have your typical management structure, your approval layers, and this is how an organization needs to function, then it's just never going to work for a brand storyteller or for, you know, the folks that you need to hire as well. I think authentic storytelling is a lost art. I don't even think it was kickstarted. But having said that, this whole build in public movement that's happening, right? And Twitter is a great source for that. And you will see some of the folks with great following and are able to hire really well are folks who are doing this exercise of being able to openly communicate, here's where we are doing well. And some orgs are also extremely radical by communicating, here's where our revenue is. Here's where our GMV or whatever numbers that matter to them, right? Number of hires they make. Even people who leave, they're like, okay, here's where things have not worked out for us. So that's a radical way of doing it. But you will notice a small faction of people who are talking about this. And all of those folks have been able to do really, really well in hiring and also building brand for that particular organization. And you will see a number of them, especially on Twitter, doing this really, really well. And these are all sort of new age founders who understand the power of being so transparent. It's a pity that so many orgs don't get it. But I think they'll have to toe that line at some point or the other.
Right. This is wonderful. I think the idea that you expose yourself and it's actually something that attracts people and you don't have to hide behind us. We already have a great culture. All you need to do is come and fit in. No, you're actually helping to build and take it forward. I mean, if at all, it's that growth mindset in action where you're saying we are not good enough yet. You will help us get there. So, talking of founders, do you think that, especially first-time founders, they tend to overlook the role of all of this. And it is your second-time founder or the one who's kind of burnt his fingers in the past, thought didn't think so much about culture. They're the ones who are a little more aware of this. My second part to this is, what is a good time for a founder to think about these aspects? Because they have plenty on their plate. But what's the best time in which they should also think about all of this?
My own thinking on this has changed a bit, right? Initially, I would always say, don't ever think of sort of talent branding, at least when you're Series B and later, right? But even that's a weird way of putting it. The definition of Series A and Series B also has changed so much, right? Because nowadays, Series A is all 30 million plus. But it depends on the kind of startup you are, right? If you're a consulting startup, then talent branding is everything for you. Right, because or even if you're in SaaS, because then you need people to narrate interesting stories, or a B2B sort of org, then you need a talent branding role, right? You can change how this is structured. It need not be called a talent branding role. It can be called a brand role, right? So there is no clear answer to this. At one point, I did have a clear answer. My answer was simple that, look, this is not code job. You need to figure out product. You need to figure out marketing. All of these are important other functions. So therefore, conventionally Series B, which would be what, 20 million or maybe lesser than there, somewhere there, that is when you start figuring out, okay, I need to build out this role, and then you build it out as a branding role, and then maybe you structure it down to others. But if I look at the market now, I say probably even Series A companies need this, right? Because your need for talent is across the board, number one. Number two is, now automatically, because you have across the board, you have talent branding practitioners who are also focusing on brand. You can't just focus on this side of things. It's impossible to build it out one way, right? So then you're saying, okay, then I need to hire a head of brand, and I need that brand person to focus on things, because my marketing team is now just focusing on growth, right? PR, somewhere there, here and there, leadership, you know, all of that I can get, but I'd rather get one person for brand and get that person to focus on all of these aspects, including PR. So no easy answers here, but I know this for also the other side, right? Which is, considering this role is now hot and is now getting more popular, the kind of talent you need to get others on board, again, nightmare, right? Because, so for example, I'm trying to hire a content person, I think for now for about 2 months, 2.5 months. Impossible to hire someone who knows good writing. I've gone to the point now, I've said, you know what, I'm just going to give up on this. I'm going to figure out figure out a good journalist, whatever they are earning, just 2x it and say, please, I can only throw money at you. Just forget journalism. Come and do this at an organization. So there's no easy answers for this at all, right? And your burn as well, because writing, at least nowadays, is changing. But before, people who were had about, let's say, 5 years experience, they used to get less than 15 to 16 lakhs max an annum, which is nothing, right? Compared to what the value that a good writer adds, immense value, because they are storytelling core aspects that others just can't. So one is the paucity of talent, and two is for a Series A startup, 15 lakhs to get that one employee to do this is not a big deal. They can afford it very, very easily. So I guess right from the get-go, because that's the nature of the market, and you have no other choice but to swim in this market and figure out among all the problems that you have.
So folks listening to this podcast and listening to Aditya, it's not just a war for engineers, it's also a war out there for a good anyone who can write reasonably well. And actually, I'm surprised that we're talking about this in 2021, that we need people who can write and read, right? It's sort of like we've regressed. So, you know, while you get these specialists to come and capture and tell the stories, one thing that you managed to also do at Gojek, and I'm sure you will be doing this later as well, is to get people from the company to contribute, right? To use them, to help them tell their stories. So I remember reading one of your blog posts where you talked about the different ways in which you got people to contribute. And I think it's wonderful because, again, it's back to that authenticity. You can only amplify their stories. You would probably help them tell it better, but it has to originate with them. So, and we also know this is not in their top 10, top 100 list of priorities. So tell me, how did you manage to rope these people in? What did you do that work?
Got it. So again, I would say undue credit to me because what happened was, again, high ownership bias, right? Everyone who joined just sort of, the beauty of the org was structured like that, right? Which you told everyone you are an owner. Don't behave like an employee where you need to be spoon-fed and you need adult supervision. No, you have to figure out what things need to be done. So the moment folks realized, okay, I am the owner of this problem or this product or this sort of function, I need to do well and abide by this. So all I did was came and said, there is the only way you're going to be able to hire for your team is if you're able to write and generate content. And so that's number one. So seeding that idea became important, right? So that's number one. Number two is, for some people, I had to incentivize them, saying that, okay, look, I'm going to write all this, but why should I do it? So then I said, okay, we'll give you Amazon vouchers and things like that. And then we sort of sweetened the deal by saying that if you have like good, deeply researched articles, you'll get like an iPhone or like a Samsung phone, all of that. So that just added this layer. But let's be real here. We are talking to engineers, product managers who earn a significant amount that they don't need your pity, you know, 2,000, 3,000 rupees. It's not important. So what we did differently is we said, our job is to make sure whatever you write goes to the right set of people. Now that became a sort of game changer, right? Which is saying, write a good article, and we will ensure you get distribution, which is conventional distribution tactics that marketing will roll out, where other engineers or product managers or your peers will get to read this. And then your own brand equity will improve, right? And the subset of that is the org's brand equity anyway improves. So that sort of incentivized folks to be able to want to contribute more, right? And then, of course, we added all these layers where we said, okay, we'll take care of editorial. We'll help you with structure and flow. For a lot of folks, I sat and brainstormed about what interesting topics that they have in mind, what ideas they had in mind, all of that. Now, this is a template that I tell everyone, right? Now, again, the beauty of it is I know the majority of them will not be able to follow this template and do this. For the simple reason, again, you need the kind of talent to be able to sit with folks and talk to them and understand this. Now, I got very lucky early on because I had some really good people who explained all of this to me. They explained, okay, this is Golang is a programming language. What is a programming language? So on and so forth, right? I had some really good educated folks who explained all this to me. And then, of course, I had the obvious curiosity to want to go and read and build this. And then talk in a language engineers will understand, ask them the right kind of questions, prepare for all my meetings, not to appear so stupid and waste people's time, all of that jazz. Again, finding the right people to win trust and to be able to do this is a big, big deal. Yeah, so it's a bunch of these factors, but if I were to just sort of summarize all of it, there needs to be some incentive and some monetary, right? There needs to be some incentive for people to write and contribute. And if you are saying that I'm going to be able to market this, I'm going to be able to promote these things, and I'm going to be able to build some brand for yourself as well. And yeah, that's where I think we did really, really well.
Yeah. So different things are going to appeal to different kinds of people, I guess. Also, you know, everyone does want to be acknowledged, noticed for their work. So this is a great way to bring that out. So one question I had is that, you know, we're talking about engineers and so on. What about people in leadership? So do you have to kind of encourage them to become their own storytellers? Because they'll have different kinds of stories to talk. And in general, do you encourage more and more people to just know the basics of, say, storytelling or even spotting that story, bringing it to the team to help them take it forward? Do you think people should just turn on that antenna a little bit more?
Yeah, you have to have people in the leadership batting for your org, right? Mm-hmm. And if they're not batting for your org, Two things there. One is probably they're not so confident about the org. So that's number one. And number two is, of course, they don't have the time and they don't realize the importance of doing this in the public domain, right? And for us, this became very easy because we had a bunch of leaders who just sort of understood, okay, I really, really like the org. And now, because I can't just say that I like the org, I have to show, I have to demonstrate and say why this is interesting. So the how became very, very important. So in this sense, it was, okay, we need to hire a senior product manager. How would we go about doing this? All the conventional ways. And then people realized, okay, look, product manager itself is like such a new thing, right? Otherwise, we are falling into the trap of program management, right? So then we'll say, okay, draft a JD. Again, now JD, how many people read and what? How do you structure this problem? What do you write? And then they'll come up with, okay, this is what a good product manager should be like. So then my job became very easy. Okay, look, great article. We can put this out. Why don't you go talk about this on social media? And why don't you sort of put a tweet storm or put it on LinkedIn and says what makes for a great product manager or what kind of product manager you're looking for? And then all your marketing activities then took over. We'll share that post, we'll promote that post, so on and so forth. And then once leadership realized a lot more people were interacting with them, and a lot more people wanted advice from them, and a lot more people wanted to talk to them, or people had opinions, or people had a different lens at approaching it. Then they realized, okay, these are interesting conversations I'm having. So now I'm willing to dedicate a certain portion of my time to do this on social media because I am also in some sense learning something, but also in a broader sense, I'm able to hire better. I'm also putting out how I think this needs to function. And there's an audience who's listening to me and is captivated by what I'm saying, right? And of course, we had to build this out at Gojek, right? And of course, we had to look at all our leaders and say, hey, here are interesting things you can talk about. Hey, share this article, please. Hey, do you have an opinion on this? Hey, do you have a framework on how this needs to work and so on? And all of them just aligned. I hate that word, but all of them just sort of came into this this idea of how this needs to work. And yeah, it just helped me as a brand marketer because then I immediately had ambassadors for the organization who went ahead and made their own share of noise. And it all just, again, came together with the function that I was trying to propagate. But yeah, initial days, we did do this for a lot of leaders, especially getting them into conferences and talks just sort of amplified that. But big, big level up. And the beauty of it is, this, right? So I know enough stories where organizations try to structure this. And the way they do that is, a marketing person, write something for me that I can post on social media. Never works because a marketing person will never have that domain knowledge that your own leader has. Correct. And time again, people do this. And then, I get this, right? Hey, did you see the CTO of this company put this up? And it was so stupid because I'm just reading that and thinking, oh God, what is this utter rubbish? This is, you know that a marketing person has written this, right? At best, the marketing person can correct grammar, maybe improve structure and flow, maybe give some references to polish it. But that's where it ends. It has to come from the leader. And the majority of them don't get it. And if they do, then it's going to get easier for them.
Right. I mean, I hate the moment when you said, oh God, align. Because it's essentially the kind of thing you would see in a very sort of templatized sort of a document, right? And so I sense this running thread of, keep watching out for differentiation. Keep watching out for your authenticity. Don't sacrifice that. Maybe use a more mundane, everyday, normal word, but don't fall in that PREs, corporates sort of thing. So, since we're talking a little bit about leaders and, the function is kind of something that people understand sort of intuitively what it brings to the table, but more formally, how does a function like this show its values? Because it's sort of, you're playing a sort of long game. You don't have numbers like I want 5 applicants to my JD, right? That's not the best way to look at this. So in your opinion, what are the best signals or metrics that one should look at to assess this in its true sense?
This is, again, organizations tend to get this wrong, right? So the role you're hiring has to have a strong buy-in with leadership, right? So you need to hire someone whom the founder or the senior, whoever the senior leader is, right? Let's say if it's in a CPO's office or a founder who does the hire, or if it's a chief marketing officer, whoever that person is, has to have strong sort of sense of this person is the right candidate for me. That's number one. if that does not work, and if you're hiring for a junior role and say do brand, it's never going to work. It has to be right there at the senior role, right? And you think of it like this: when you hire for a public relations person, the PR person has to, in some ways, engage with the CEO of the company, right? So and with investors and potentially all of that for startups typically, right? So if you don't have a strong PR person here who knows writing and things like that, it's never going to work. Very similar in that sense, right? As an example, the way this is, has to be structured, and there's no other way to do this, right, is to figure out what are the core tenets this person will look at in the first 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and 1 year. And the beauty of when I joined this first month, I was told, don't do anything, just observe the org, right? So I had nothing to do. In fact, for the entire year, I didn't have important sort of, if you looked at my OKRs and said, okay, show me what you've done, like a conventional sort of marketing person or anyone would have just fired me. They said, okay, I don't see anything here. I don't see any value here. There's nothing you've really done. But what we did was typical janitorial work, which is just hygiene, clean up the channels, clean up the website, make sure everything is solid. And if people come and visit all of these properties at some point, they will only have to see great content. So clean up all the rubbish that's there, right? Restructure everything, change the format of how an article needs to look like, so on and so forth. Even till date, when people ask me, tell me metrics that matter for this role, very difficult to say it, right? I'll give it a shot, right? Like, here are things that I think mattered. Number one is we looked at the number of resumes that came in via the website. Right. So that will give you an idea. In that resumes, we looked at cost per developer resume, which is how many of them were developers only, developers, product managers, whoever. And we divided that by the cost we spent to do all of these activities, right? Promotions, whatever we did. The third one would be how many of them are for tier one companies that we had categorized as tier one. So maybe your Facebook and all of those companies, right? Like, okay, these are your tier one companies. Let's categorize that. So those are some important metrics. But I think, and then of course you can track all your impressions, your likes and shares and posts and like how all this post performed. There are a whole bunch of those to track, right? But I think all of these metrics are not as, they don't convey the pulse of the team or the function, right? Another one we did was we started surveying employees who have joined us, right? And whoever joined us, we said, okay, tell us, how did you hear about us? Did you hear about Gojek from a friend, or was it from a blog post, so on? So that gave some sort of efficacy in the channel, and that's directly from someone we have hired, right? So that became sort of easier. So that was one of them. So look, there are all these metrics, but I think ultimately, the reason why I started this by saying that you need incredible amounts of trust with the founder or whoever this function head is hiring is because the best way to do this is anecdotal examples of how this function is working. That is the only way this works. You need to hire a brand person. Don't bog them with PPTs and all the reporting structures and saying, please tell me what you're doing every week. Let's have catch-up calls. The moment you sort of institutionalize and do 10 things on this and tell me what metrics you're hitting, let's track those metrics, they are going to miss out on what the job is. The job is to be able to put out great content.
Correct.
And that has to be the voice of your individual teams, right? Hire that person, trust that person to do the job. Once in a while, catch up and say, okay, what is the progress that's been made? Are you looking at hygiene? Are you looking at getting the right kind of content out? And instinctively, you will know that, right? If your readership is methodically increasing, you know this person is in the right track. But after 2, 3, 6, 9 months, if the readership is just not improved, the quality of the content is not great, right? So there are obvious metrics, but invariably, again, I can assure you that also will complicate this. They will not look at simple things like, is readership increasing? No, that's too small a metric to present, right? Because that's not a good enough metric. We need bigger, stronger metrics, so on and so forth. So yeah, simple things like that. And then eventually, anecdotally, you will realize this. So my boss at Gojek, anecdotally, he kept getting people saying that, hey, great article, or hey, amazing. I saw a Gojek ad. It was so smart. I don't think anyone would have understood this. Or hey, I was reading something about Gojek, or someone told me something about Gojek and they realized this. Or hey, I read something, one of your leaders posted, I thought it was very, very smart. So anecdotally, you will have all of these examples coming through. And I think that really shined. And one of the reasons why this worked so beautifully at Gojek was we had leaders who trusted the function, number one. And B is they said, we're not going to hold you accountable for metrics and things like that, because we understand that this is a process. And it's a long-term process. and we'll make it happen. The beauty of it was it lasted one year and 2-3 months till we did our first ATL campaign, and that did really, really well. And we got a lot of applauders for that. But once that tempered down, consistency maintained, and after 1.8 years or so, Gojek just became that amazing brand. So it seems like an overnight success, but all those grassroots were laid way, way, way in advance. But yeah, I've spoken about this to multiple orgs, and I've told multiple people how this needs to be structured. I can also guarantee you that orgs and will not structure it this way at all. They'll always hire someone and they'll say, okay, tell me if it's going well, what are our metrics, what are our numbers, and that's where they'll fail. And I feel like that's where a competitive advantage for me is, right? Because probably among the rare few people who can say that, look, I've already built this function. Correct. So you're talking to someone who's already done this. So please let me do my job, and then you can hold me accountable much, much later on. So yeah, as someone in this function, for me, it gets a lot more easier because I know how all the other orgs will fail in this.
So who's the right person for a, you know, head of such a function to report to, in your opinion?
Okay, so again, I've gone through an evolution on this, right? For it depends on the organization. So if an organization is completely engineering driven, like a consultancy, then it, or like an engineering sort of consultancy, then it has to be with the engineer, right? If you're an product driven organization, like let's say your typical Swiggy, Zomato, and everything, then it needs to sit with the product person. And the simple reason for that is because you read, if one person is able to read a PRD, right, you will get everything about that organization systematically, or that one particular problem statement that they're trying to solve. And it gets very easy to write a story on that problem statement. So yeah, depends on the kind of organization, but here's where I think it should definitely not sit. This is where roles die, right? HR, I don't think it should sit with HR for sure, because HR is not evolved to get there. Like what can the HR person tell you apart from cultural aspects of the organization? But that's not your role. You want to be explaining about product. You want to be explaining about engineering. You want to be explaining about design, right? So those are core tenets you want to propagate in the employer branding. So definitely not here. Number two is definitely not with recruitment, because it has nothing to do with recruitment. You're a storyteller. Correct. Your outcome is recruitment, which I think the recruitment team anyway needs to look at. They need to look at those numbers. What is my funnel? And so on and so forth, right? So definitely not HR, definitely not recruitment. If it sits in the sort of CEO's office, I think that's great, especially for little smaller organizations, because then you're directly interacting with the CEO. Some of the best stories originate from there, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's also a great fit. But again, evolution of the organization. If you're a Series D, E startup, and if you're still figuring out, do I need this, then probably not. It will never sit with the CEO, because the CEO himself cannot give time, right? So then you need to figure out other ancillary functions. So yeah, no straitjacket answer, but definitely not with HR recruitment for sure.
Right. And it's a slight indictment on some of these traditional functions that they haven't really bothered to find out what design does or what product does. And unfortunately, they should have probably been playing this role by now. But I think we can go talk on and on about that. So we won't. One question I had was that, a lot of people who've done content around employer branding, especially pre-pandemic, the handful of them that were doing it, a big part of that was the site, right? How your place looks, these amazing facilities we've had. And at some point, that tended to be a kind of a stand-in for culture, our foosball table. So now with things gone distributed, has the narrative sort of changed more in terms of those intangible things you can't show? And how do you make it visible and tangible? Is that a challenge that you've had to encounter?
Yeah, I think that's a phenomenal question, right? Like, and I'll explain why. The beauty of going to an org and working in an organization is you get a lot of these sort of intangible benefits, these serendipitous moments that matter in an organization, right? In a virtual Zoom call, to build those relationships and trust is extremely complex and very, very difficult. Great question, right? And I feel like this is where I feel cultural things that need to be done by HR teams, they're just not doing it, right? I know a couple of folks, one of them is this folk called Sanket, who's built this really cool thing on Slack, which is like a pop trivia quiz on Slack, and it's a little bit of gaming, a little bit of interesting things on Slack, right? So a lot of folks have done very, very interesting things like this, but not enough folks have focused on how do I look at cultural aspects. And the closest folks have come to is, hey, we'll do a Zoom virtual party. I have Netflix for that. There's no way this is going to happen on Zoom to make this work. So replicating the offline environment is extremely complex. And I think interesting things need to be done. And so, for example, one thing I had is the HR team mandating that teams now have to come together and they have to play a board game together. They have to do this for half an hour or 45 minutes. Things like that, where you're looking at cultural aspects and when you're looking at bond, team building, I don't think it's being done. And that is what happens in an offline environment in office. So building this out now, it needs to sit with HR. And it's very difficult for talent branding to be able to dig out these stories because all those water cooler moments are now dead, right? My function has typically struggled to do this well. Let's see how this goes. I don't have a direct answer.
Right. I mean, interestingly, one of the things that we happened to get into because we were helping one, leader kind of build a lot of awareness about the cultures that they had chosen was just to kind of start a Slack channel for them and do some of the things that you mentioned, in terms of running trivia and all that. But they also kind of invited people to this a summary session about there's a book about Netflix, right? No Rules, Rules. People were very curious to know what the culture at Netflix is like. And it's been spoken about at this book. So we spoke about that book, and in the process, there were all these stories that just came up about how candor was practiced in this organization. And candor happened to be one of the values both at Netflix and this organization. And that story, someone just captured it. We just turned it into a small shareable piece of content. And you kind of have to organically lead them to those conversations. It cannot be, here's half an hour, please play a game. And at the end of it, we want these five things, because it's back to that metrics thinking that you just spoke about a short while ago, right? You cannot replicate it. So I think, things are happening. How do you capture them and turn them into that seed of a great story is going to need a lot of imagination, I think, from a lot of folks.
Yeah. I actually love your example of doing this, right? I think it's a great example. Like, how many times has the HR team sort of institutionalized this and said, people read a lot. Like, every company has this hashtag books channel, right? Okay. Which I think is great. At best, what I've seen is one person comes and talks about a book, right? But how many times have you said, okay, individual teams, please have a session where you talk about the book, right? And make sure we'll allocate half an hour where it's not a company-wide thing, right? It's not one person speaking to the entire company, but every team has to pitch in, and it's mandatory attendance and where you have to talk about these things. Like, that's forcefully being able to help culture. I'm talking about large organizations, right? These are the kind of things that you need to do, which I think is just not being done.
Correct. Yeah. And I think everyone has something to contribute, but just get into this environment where you feel, it's all about work. And I think that's where having seen other people get their stories out can have this sort of positive cycle. So Aditya, about 10 minutes left. So let me ask you a few more questions before I get to a more sort of personal sort of questions. One is that, what are the kinds of channels that you think companies need to invest in to get their story out? One is, there is the world of PR. You have external established sources to go to. That's its own game. But if companies were starting from scratch, investing in their own channels, what sort of channels should you just absolutely have before you can think of bigger and broader things?
Again, very, very easy, right? You need to have think of a candidate. A candidate wants to know about your company, right? There are some things you can control. There are some things you can't control. Okay. Can't control things like Glassdoor. What else? Glassdoor is the one big thing you can't control. And also just generally word of mouth.
Perception. Yeah, you can't control anyone pitching about you to someone else.
You can't control any of this, right? So then you have to categorize, okay, own media. How thin can I spread myself now? So own media, LinkedIn, you obviously need that because people need to identify who your company is, what, and that's where people go and search. So you definitely need LinkedIn. Twitter becomes a great distribution platform, and this is where great content is there. So you need Twitter. So general social media landscape, you need to do a quick audit of your industry and figure out, okay, I need the landscape there, right? Three is blog. This is where you need to invest heavily, right? Have a good blog where you're talking about problems. You're talking about leadership. This is the caliber of my leadership. And then lastly, you're talking about interesting things the company has done. So for example, a funding announcement. Here is an evolution of a product that we have launched, or things like that, right? So blog becomes one strong component. And every time you publish that blog and you just put it in your website, it's not going to get anywhere. So you use channels like LinkedIn, Twitter as a distribution mechanism, right? So yeah, Twitter, LinkedIn, a blog, I think three absolute essentials to kick off. And then YouTube, you know, you folks are doing podcasts and things like that. Correct. Then you need to figure out what are the other channels. Start with their bare essentials and then move on as you get more people and contribute on this.
Yeah, and would you advise things like, you know, meetups and having so your own small forums to get people talking and things like that?
Yeah, so meetups and things like that are a little more high agency mm-hmm. things, right? So you start with this and then you build out a strong pipeline over all of this, especially when you're just starting off, right? And then meetups and conferences. But remember this, right? Like when you have a meetup, the caliber of the speaker has to be really, really good. You need to vet the speaker, make sure they know what you're talking about. And it can't be generic yarn. Like 90% of people who come and talk is all generic yarn, right? So you either pick one. One of the interesting things that people have realized is, okay, we're getting everyone to do generic yarn. Let's do product teardown now. Right. So they pick one product and they're like, let's tear it down one by one. Why this button is here? Why this feature is here? Interesting stuff. So yeah, do that, but make sure all the others are sorted out. And then, yeah.
Yeah. So behind the scenes things, I think always something people love to hear. All right. So Aditya, before we close, a few questions about what you've done to stay relevant. You've done a lot of things already and you think you clearly are interested in so many things. And I'm glad you spoke about reading and writing. Because it's just timeless stuff, right? So I know you're a little bit into history, or not little bit, I think is an understatement. So tell me a little bit about history and how, you know, does it really, how does it help you? I mean, what do you get out of reading history?
Okay, so I've actually scaled that down significantly, right? I'm not as equipped or knowledgeable as I used to be. At least I've stopped reading a lot more. But I do read... I've also stopped reading a lot of books, right? I used to be a voracious reader and used to read tons of books, but now it's become articles, podcasts, and so many other distractions. I fail to, and I'm ashamed to say this, but you know, it is what it is, right? In fact, I tend to read more fiction now because I'm anyway devouring and consuming all of nonfiction anywhere, right? And everything, right? Like, so for example, Twitter's become this great force of distraction and good, right? Because you read something interesting and then you're like, okay, I'm going to check this article out. So I've noticed my time being expended everywhere, but then I don't control it because I've realized, okay, all knowledge is good knowledge. But yeah, specifically on why history has helped, it's able to sort of deduce context for me. If you read history, right, you will always notice there are five other tangents to a storyline. There is never one source of truth for history. Right. It's not, and it's never arranged, right? So there's that Freakonomics example, right? And it's, they'll take two completely unrelated things, right? Like, why are laddus being sold in India and why are wrestlers in Japan being able to sell laddus? And they'll tie those two things. Sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it's stupid, right? But I feel like history, historical context gives you these tangents, and these tangents help you to explore other things. And I was a big sucker for geopolitics also. So I really wanted to understand geopolitics. And I think that in some ways, things that I write also, is I'm able to pull out context, historical context, because people love a great, for example, Norse mythology. I love putting in Norse mythology examples because people also sort of relate to it. It gets easier for people to understand and read it. And you will see a lot of people also doing that who understand these things, right? Alexander the Great and Baijus, what is similar between them, right? So yeah, typically love history. And in fact, one of my favorite genres is historical fiction, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this amazing category where it's a fictional story, but with real life historical events. And I love some books in that whole
thing. Would you recommend one or two of them?
Would I recommend? Okay, one of them, one of my favorites is this book called Homecoming or Homegoing by Yaak Yassi. Mm-hmm. Absolutely phenomenal book. Absolutely love that book. Also, William Dalrymple writes some really, really amazing stuff. The White Mughal is one of my favorites. So yeah, tons and tons out there.
Great. You spoke about having all these articles open and Twitter rabbit holes and things like that. We also noticed that you have not neglected your LinkedIn. You do keep posting occasionally. So you do practice what you tell your leaders to do. So one challenge is, right, just kind of when you see something, capture it, have that tidbit. Is there by now a system for you where you kind of do this very systematically, of time set aside, you have tools and bookmarks and things like that, or is it still fairly ad hoc? And if it's the former, you've kind of worked out some components. Can you tell us some tools, apps, approaches that have worked for you?
Oh, this is a huge one. I have like a whole bunch of frameworks on not frameworks as much as how do I consume plus how do I post, right? But the simple rule is this. I've not done a good job at LinkedIn. I'll admit this. I've not done a good job because I feel like it's not. So the LinkedIn audience is there for because they see, okay, you are a particular leader in your function and we expect you to post things on that function. That's how LinkedIn is structured, right? But Twitter's not structured like that. Twitter's like you're a personality. Okay. And I want to understand as a personality, what are the facets you have? So things that go on LinkedIn and things that go on Twitter are completely different. But the way I've treated it, I'm like both platforms are the same. I don't have time for LinkedIn. I'm just going to see whatever I post on Twitter. I'll just cross post that on LinkedIn. I've used that, which means in some ways you could say I've done a disservice to how LinkedIn is structured, right? But I honestly don't care much on how I look at LinkedIn. I'm more interested on Twitter. And I'll tell you why. The beauty of Twitter is whatever information I put out, right? Invariably, in a lot of cases, A, there's room for debate, right? And of course, for some people, this debate gets into an area where the people are just rude and offensive. But luckily, I've never got into that space, right? And I've been very fortunate in that space. But one is room for debate. So you get to engage and learn interesting things, number one. Number two is, in some context, when I put out information on a particular story, I get to learn a lot more about that one particular story because I've realized that a summation of people is far more knowledgeable, correct, right? And the Twitter feed crunches you to that 140 characters, 280 characters.
280.
Right? So invariably, you consume a lot more. And at the same time, if you're interested and you click on one particular thing, you can see people responding and their opinions on that particular thing, right? So the information gathering and information that you're consuming is far, far higher on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And my simple rule on this is very simple. You read something interesting you think is very cool. Mm-hmm. You want to know more about it. Post it on Twitter. People will tell you more about it. So I use it in that fashion. And the other ways I also use it as a repository to be able to track how my own thinking is and how my own evolution is of how I'm processing frameworks, how I'm processing principles, a product way of looking at things, like different things like that. But yeah, it's been really helpful for me.
You mentioned history, you mentioned geopolitics. Any other domains in which you kind of just keep tabs on or take inspiration for the kind of work you do right now?
I love reading annual reports of companies. Mm-hmm. I think treasure trove of knowledge, amazing. People don't do this enough, right? You read an annual report of a company, you will come out incredibly knowledgeable. The pulse, and especially for India, right? You read a Reliance annual report, you'll come back understanding an insane amount of knowledge. Sure. Like who controls the TV empire, where are the levers for a particular business. So yeah, annual reports are a big deal. Podcasts, again, I listen to a lot of podcasts, but again, companies and things like that. Anything I want on the softer aspects of fiction, books. But yeah, geopolitics, history, companies and how companies are built. I do once in a while, I tend to listen to a particular product and how it's structured, where are its numbers coming from, who are the consumption patterns, all of this via podcast, but generally about companies is another area that really, really interests me.
Very interesting. Are there certain companies or leaders that you look at who are doing a good job of employer branding that someone should start following just to get a sense of what the gold standard really is?
I don't know about employer branding, but if I would look at branding as a whole, mm-hmm. right? Of course, I feel Kunal Shah does a fantastic job at this. Mm-hmm. And he's cracked this to a point where he sets the pace and sets the standard for what needs to be spoken as well. Right? That it becomes like a theme when Kunal Shah talks about it. And fantastic job with this. But other folks, I think my own boss, Sidhu Punappa, right, does a fantastic job with this because he understands that he's like the voice for engineering. This is what he really, really understands. So he does a fantastic job of consistently talking about engineering, right? So I think he does a really, really good job with this. So yeah, these two people really stand out. And I think they've had a fantastic Twitter game. There are other folks who use it differently, right? Like, so one of my folks whom I quite like now, and I've done this, I followed him and I've seen him grow is Mahesh, who leads recruitment at an academy. And I think he does a really, really good job. He posts memes and just posts like fun stuff, right? That's all he does. But in some ways that translates into how the org thinks and how the org behaves. And he's done a fantastic job of just memes, fun things, and that's it. Like, this is my Twitter profile, but great, like fun person to follow, and you're always engaged in something funny on the startup ecosystem. But yeah, some examples.
You don't have to kind of toe the playbook. Just you can do different things and still get noticed for it.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. So last segment, Aditya, we call this the future relevance of X. I'm going to toss out a few X's at you, and just tell me what comes to mind in terms of their future relevance. And if you want to pass, you can. Let's start with the future relevance of HR, old style HR.
Dead. Should I give a one word answer or should it be more?
One word is fine, but you don't have to qualify it. But if you want to say more, go ahead.
You don't even need me to say this. Yeah. Anyone and everyone will say this. The only people who don't say it is they're scared for their where they work. But largely, abysmal job at what they need to be doing. And hopefully things get better. And I think it will do. There is no other choice. You have to be able to do better by the org. So yeah, let's see. Let's see how that goes.
Fair enough. Corporate blogs.
I think beautiful because if people write and it's just pasted there, no one cares. No one goes to see it. It's just there. But the beauty of this is this, like you'll get a digital marketer, you'll promote it, and then you'll say, hey, I got like 1 million impressions on my blog. And finance is like, oh, wow, amazing stuff. You got 1 million impressions. Everyone's happy. But no one's read that story. It's the difference between reading a story versus impressions. Corporate blogs need to majorly reinvent themselves. But also, having said that, sometimes I feel it's not the marketer's problem, right? What has happened, or the talent branding person's problem? What has happened is organizations of founders and leaders are so averse to talking about some things that they don't give you the opportunity to talk, to narrate interesting stories. So it's a two-way problem. I won't blame one side alone, but again, how many people are doing really interesting stuff and have good stories to narrate and have a leadership who allows you to narrate those? Far and few in between. So not as good, I would say, as of now.
Okay. Second last topic, the future relevance of influencers.
Oh, big deal. We are in the midst of the influencer economy, right? You can also, in many ways, you can say your own leadership is in some ways in influencers, right? You're building them up to be influencers.
Correct.
Yeah, I think really, really big say in how brands are built, and you can look at micro influencers, and you can look at, you know, influencers with just like 2,000, 3,000 followers and what part they play as well. Huge. Companies have to figure out a way where they get employees to also bat for them, because collectively they can get far, far stronger. And I feel like that is the evolution of where in the next 3 years, 4 years, how many people are talking about, like a great example I would like to quote over here is Razorpay. You will notice a lot of employees of this Razorpay especially are more active on social media, and they're batting for their organization. And you will notice that trend, especially for Razorpay as compared to other companies. I think it's fabulous. And it all comes down, right? It makes sense, because then you look at the founders who have a great fortune of working with, and I know them. So it's not like it was forced on them, but it's incidental, and people have realized, okay, we want to go and talk more about a company because it's so amazing. Greatest testimonial to how an org is built. Amazing example.
Lovely. And the last one, the future relevance of the story.
Of the story. I said this a while back, right? The difference between Uber being valued at $6 billion to $53 billion later hinged on only one aspect, and that's storytelling. And this is not my words. This is words from Aswath Damodaran, who wrote the valuation thesis for Uber, and Bill Gurley, the investor, who changed it by saying, hey, we are not a transportation startup. We are a mobility startup. And that just expounded. So how important is story? I myself know enough examples of how storytelling has helped you raise massive amounts of money, right? And your Series A is what? You don't have product, you don't have anything. You have a story, and that's the story you sell. So the importance of story and the storytellers are going to be the next crorepatis. That's my hunch.
All right, Aditya, here's to more stories and more big stories to you. Thank you so much for your time on the CTQ Smartcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure hearing you as well on so many examples. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
If you like this, we know you care about your and your team's future relevance. You can find us and click on the subscribe button on YouTube, Spotify, Google and Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook and Instagram. There are two ways to enter the insider group of friends of CTQ. A Telegram channel where you'll get daily tidbits that help you think about future relevance, and our weekly email newsletter called The Upleveler. We've got some fabulous testimonials from our subscribers. We share special discount codes for CTQ compounds and exclusive invitations to our events on both these channels. Just go to choosetothink.com, that is think with a Q, and you'll find all the links to subscribe. You owe it to yourself.